Good job. Do you want to be program chair? My name is Dennis, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dennis.
And I was thinking today about coming down here, and that I may have spoken at the Seattle group once before. And this would have been in 78 or 79. I got sober on January 13th, 1976. So a couple of years later, I was asked to speak. And this was when the Alano Club, which was the earliest phase of Seattle Inner Group, was at the IOGT Hall on Capitol Hill. And so I went to this meeting, scared crapless, and the hall was quite elegant. It was a great big room, and we were up on a stage, and I walked up to this podium, and the first thing I saw on the podium was a huge sign that said, "Do not swear." And the first thing I did was I looked up at the crowd of people who were there, and I said, "Shit, I can't do this." I didn't do it on purpose, it just sort of slipped out of me. I think that was the Seattle group. I mean, and Austria and the rest of you who are trying to re-energize this group, I think it's great. We think that this was probably the first group in Seattle. It's cool. They use this format, and that what we're doing it now, they always had a suspect, and the suspect spoke, and then somebody had been around for a while, then spoke. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself and being an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will try not to swear. For those of you who don't know, there may be a lot of references tonight to AA history in Washington, but it's because I'm working on the revision of our AA history book for Washington, and I mean, there's all this stuff that's flowing through me all the time. So that's how I remembered about the Seattle group. I did not come from an alcoholic family. My dad was in the military, and we traveled a lot. There was a lot of drinking in the military world, but my parents weren't much in the way of drinkers. My dad probably was an alcoholic, but mostly he just couldn't handle his liquor, and he'd get kind of sleepy drunk, and that would be kind of the end of his game. And my mother would drink along with him, and she couldn't handle very much either. And so I had very little experience about drinking. And as a kid, I was told, you know, if you break the law or break any rules, this is my dad, he said, "I'll get in trouble for it," because he was in the military. So that was a good club over my head to not pull anything. So I never got in any trouble. I never did anything. And I didn't start drinking until, like Chad, I went to college. Mostly, I was this kid who didn't feel very good about himself and never told the truth to anybody about who I was or what was going on. Well, it turns out those are characteristics of an alcoholic. And so I acted like an alcoholic from a very early time before booze ever got close to me. I never wanted to look at myself and see who I was, and I never wanted you to know who I was. So I spent a lot of time in the early years of my life telling lies, which comes back to me on a regular basis. It is encourage me to seek and to tell the truth. Thank God for the program. So my story is I was a very smart kid and got a scholarship and went to the University of Denver and got drunk the first night I was in the dormitory and was put on social probation for wandering around drunk as a skunk telling people all this crazy stuff. This was my big chance, and I just went ballistic as far as drinking. A sense of freedom came over me on my first drinks. From that point on, I drank as much as I could, as often as I could, until I finally stopped in 1976. After college and being on social probation, I went to school someplace else and then to someplace else. And finally graduated from the University of San Francisco and decided to go into the Army. And this would have been in the 60s, Vietnam was going on. And people thought I was nuts to join the Army, but I mean, I was raised in the Army, so that seemed like home and I felt comfortable there. It never occurred to me, I just happened to be a homosexual. It never occurred to me that that was kind of a dumb thing to do, to join the Army, since it was illegal to be one. So I got past that part by telling a lie when I had to fill in the form. I checked no when it asked if I was, and so that's how I got into the military. Since my dad was an officer, I wanted to be one too, and I graduated from officer's candidate school and became a lieutenant. And from there, a friend of mine, who we drank a lot whenever we had a chance, told me that he was going to go to the intelligence school to become an agent. I never heard of this, but it sounded very cool. So I applied as well and ended up becoming a military intelligence special agent. And my job was to investigate backgrounds of people to make sure that they could be given a security clearance. I was very proud of myself and very happy about it, and I drank as much as I could, as often as I could, and I got away with it because the guys that I lived with were as big as drunks as I was. And you just sort of learned how to function and drink. There was no special night for drinking. Drinking was drinking. You did it when you could, and I drank a lot. I was assigned, my first job was I was assigned to Korea because there was a big scandal had happened, and one of our ships was captured. So they thought there was going to be a war breakout in Korea, so a bunch of us military intelligence agents were sent over there. And I became the editorial officer. All the secret writing and reports about the North Koreans and the South Koreans and everybody's undercover activities all went through my office. It was a very responsible job. I was very good about it. It was great. When I came back to the States, I had decided it was time for me to deal with my homosexuality, which I had never done anything about in the military. So I saw this newspaper that had an advertisement for a gay movie, and I applied to come back to the States to go to San Francisco so I could be assigned there because that's where the movie was. And ultimately, I became the chief of investigations for the 9 Western states. I finished out my tour of duty in the Army as a captain and chief of investigations. My life was filled with lies. They had found out about who I really was, they would have taken my clearance away and probably tried to kick me out of the Army, but they didn't. And on a number of occasions in the investigations that I was responsible for, it came up that somebody was one of those, and we had to find a justification for not throwing them out, which was possible. And so I was living this really double life and felt perfectly comfortable with it. And I drank a lot. I was very good at drinking. And whenever the possibility came up, I mean, happy hour was, I think, invented by the military. I don't know, but it was certainly an integral part of the day. And every day I was there drinking and getting drunk and staggering myself home and coming into work late the next day, but performing really well because I had plenty of BS inside of me and I could do the job. I knew the angles, I knew the things, and nobody really suspected I was as devious and perverted as they would have thought I was if they really knew who I was. Somehow, underneath it all, I knew that I was living this lie, and it wasn't like my happiest time of life. So I decided I should get out of the military, and I did, with a great record. And I was promoted to captain. I stayed in San Francisco and got involved with a guy who wrote a cookbook that became one of the best-selling cookbooks in the States at that time, and I was his publisher. And I, you know, made up some stories and figured out some stuff and sort of conned him into hiring me, and I ended up being the general manager of this corporation. And that went on for a couple of years until the ego, unchecked, got carried away, and I ended up pulling some stupid stuff and fooling around with money, and it occurred to me that I'd made a mistake on a contract. So the way I could take care of that would be to raise some additional funds, which meant that I contacted this guy who said that he had sold cocaine to William Shatner, who was the Star Trek guy. And got into a deal with him and used corporate funds to purchase cocaine, and which all made, you know, this is a great idea from a really super effective brain. And ultimately, I was contacted by the Drug Enforcement Agency. I was on a trip in Boston, and they came and interviewed me, and they knew all about, you know, the guy that I was involved with. And eventually the corporate books were opened up, and there was all this misutilization of funds, and I ended up going to prison for selling drugs and for embezzling funds. And I wasn't really ashamed of myself at that point. I mean, and most people thought I was very clever, really smart, and I did too. I mean, I felt pretty good about myself. It wasn't until I got out of prison that I started feeling pretty bad about myself. And so I did time in Northern California fighting forest fires and fighting everything else. And so, I was an ex-con. After I got out, somehow something was working in my head. And the first thing that happened when I got out of prison is they let me off of the prison bus in this little town in Northern California. And I went into this drugstore and bought a fifth of whiskey and got drunk on the bus as I'm going home. So, I mean, my pattern was well set, and I felt good about that. And by the time I got to my place, I was drunk as a skunk and had all these plans about how I was going to solve problems. My parents weren't too nuts about what had happened and what I had done. And they didn't really applaud me when I walked in or tell me how much they respected me for what I had done. And that was kind of the first real feedback that I'd gotten in most of my life. Mostly because I wasn't available for feedback. I didn't want anybody to know about me, and I didn't want to know about me. That was very clear. So I decided to not stay with my family where I didn't get any respect. Mm-hmm. And I decided to come up here from Northern California. And I'm living with this funny little old house and trying to work somehow and using a lot of drugs and still being drunk all the time. And my life began to sort of fall apart. I think that finally, you know, I began to really look at what I had done and what my life was like. And I remember sitting in the backyard of this little place, supposedly meditating, but actually just feeling sorry for myself and embarrassed and ashamed. And people began to say to me that there was something wrong with me because all I ever did was talk about dying. And I would say that if there was some sort of clinical analysis of Dennis Foster at that period, it was that I was a suicidal maniac. I couldn't stand to look at what had happened. I couldn't stand taking responsibility for what I did. I hated it that my mother told me I should never do that again. She just, and I couldn't tell anybody else here. And using more drugs and being around people who were using drugs and drinking kept pushing it into my face that this was not the life I wanted to have. And that I didn't really respect these people and I didn't respect myself. And the suicidal thoughts got bigger and bigger. Fortunately, there was enough guilt built up inside of me until I was out trying to get a job from this guy on Capitol Hill, and he looked at me very seriously when I told him who I was and what I had done, and he gave me a job. And I told everybody that I had a job managing his business, when actually I was sweeping the floor and filling out the papers and stuff, but I wasn't managing his business. And one day we're driving around, and he had seen me at his Christmas party, just drunk as a skunk, trying to pick up this guy's wife right in the middle of the party. And I mean, he knew that I really wasn't into women, but that somehow the idea of picking up this guy's wife's somehow appealed to the drunk in me. Maybe it made me feel like I was cool. I don't know. So he knew that something was really weird. And he said to me as we're driving around, you know, I'm a member of AA. And maybe we should go to a meeting. I truly felt like I wanted to jump out of the car. That AA was the last possible thing I could ever be interested in. Like many of you, I had a very negative view of what AA was. And as I've said before, I mean, Chad mentioned that, you know, he learned drinking from movies. Well, I learned about AA from movies. For those who are old enough, I remember that Burt Lancaster went to AA meetings in Comeback Little Sheba, and the people were not very impressive. I didn't think very much of those people at all. They were kind of losers. And then later on, in a movie whose name I cannot remember now, Jack Lemmon was a drunk and was going to meetings. And he had a sponsor who loaned him his car, and Jack drove the car drunk into a lake. And I just thought, these people are stupid and crazy. So It seemed perfectly natural to want to jump out of his car when David suggested that we go to a meeting. But I did go to a meeting. And I sat in the meeting in Bellevue, and there was a fellow there who was kind of well known. He was on the radio or TV or something, and he was at his first meeting, and he was crying and talking about stuff. And I wasn't impressed. Oh, because he's such, seemed like such a loser, and I am not a loser. But I went back to more meetings, and somebody came up to me at one point and said, "It's really nice to have you here. I hope you come back again." And he was a very sincere, intelligent, healthy-looking guy. And I thought, I like that. So I came back again, and I started going to meetings regularly. This was the 13th of January, 1976. And I haven't had a drink since, and haven't had the desire to drink since. And haven't always been nuts about the stuff I've had to learn about myself since I've been sober. So it's easy for me to stand here and tell you my story. But no, I didn't get to be suicidal because I was happy about me or what I had accomplished. I was pretty upset. The idea of working the steps was not appealing. I mean, digging into my stuff, sharing it with somebody else, wasn't my deal at all. I didn't understand that the 12 steps were about getting outside of my self-centered self and caring about others. I didn't understand that. My sponsor, who was the guy who I worked for, was not too heavy-duty about doing the steps. So I did a kind of a sloppy job of going to meetings and shooting the crap a lot, but not really working the steps. And it took me quite a while to understand what the hell the program was about. And one of the things that was really important in my first year was that one of the things on the wall in the place that I was going to meetings was very, very clear that it said, "God as we understand him." And as we understand him answered a lot of questions that I had about this stupid program, which kept talking about God, and I had, you know, been well-read and looked at lots of different positions philosophically and practiced some Buddhism when I was in Korea, da-da-da-da-da-da. And the program didn't sound like my kind of deal, but that one phrase made it for me. And I could go there because I knew that it was God as I understood it. And it's probably the only thing I learned about the steps for the first couple of years. Slowly, I began to work the program, and I'm still here. I didn't understand that a lot of the ego that's put out in AA is just individuals' problems, you know, that the program is not about me and what I say it is or what my sponsor says it is. The program is this thing that started in 35. Two people got together trying to figure out how to stay alive, and they developed it using a lot of different information. And Bill Wilson, who was not a renowned author, wrote this book to explain how it, you know, what was going on. And we have been guided by that for many years, but it's not, our program is not dictatorial or hardly regimental. I mean, just about anybody who believes just about anything can get sober. Thank God that we don't demand that anybody change their brain, their learning ability. You know, we encourage people to look for new things, try to look inside themselves and see who they really are, to be honest, to accept the possibility of that we can be and act insane, but that our behavior is the characteristic of our disease. Our thought patterns are very typical. That's why we can joke with each other about stuff that people go, what? Because we all recognize certain elements about ourselves that other people would think were insulting. Mm-hmm. You know? Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've done some really stupid stuff in my life. Some of my ideas are absolutely ludicrous. Some of them are brilliant, but not all of them. Not everything. And the program has given me something I could never have wished for, because I could not imagine that life would be like this. That I could accept life on life's terms, that I don't have to believe something because somebody waves their finger at me and says, this is the truth, this is the way it is, that's it. You know, the only truth like that is don't drink. And the rest of the truths are, each of us has our interpretation of what the program is. Anything that I said today is directly out of the mouth of a lying drunk named Dennis. I want to be honest and to tell you the truth about what's happened, and I want to live my life that way. And when I do, my life is much better than it ever possibly was. I never realized that being honest was such an important thing. Because like I said at the beginning, I spent all of my life, the most of it, lying to cover up from myself and from everybody else who I really was. The program, in the worst of times, is the best thing for me. It's just a fact. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, like many of you, tough stuff has happened since I've gotten sober. None of my immediate family is still alive. They're all gone. I'm still here. And I will continue to be here, and I'm not going to drink. And I blend out in the program. So I think I've done enough of your time, and I want to say thank you. Thank you.